This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.
Collectively, I think these items will take about 3 minutes, and I want to set them up right after UAR 13 on the agenda. Are there any other late additions?
Just a question. Sir. Item 5 says that it is for late additions to the agenda. Is there a reason why we would not entertain those three at this point of item 5?
We can do it then. I would recommend doing it after R13 because the people involved are already up front, and it's about 3 minutes, and we'll be able to take the time out of the exec so that it can keep the meeting hybrid tracking better.
Thank you.
Are there any other late additions? Are there any objections? Hearing none, then it is so ordered. Next, approval of the minutes of April 7th, 2015. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
I move to approve the minutes.
Second. We have a motion. We have a second from
me.
Mr. Meaver. Right. Thank you. Are there any changes, additions to the minutes? Hearing none, I ask unanimous consent to approve the minutes of April 7th, 2015. Are there any objections? Hearing none, the minutes are passed as written. Updates, Executive Committee. For efficiency, I'm going to run through these pretty quickly. First, a group has asked for a donation for the staff appreciation reception that will take place April 23rd from 5 to 6:30. The UA exec discussed it. We have the funds, and we authorized $200 for the event. They will put us on as a sponsor and give us credit for it. So that's just reporting the numbers. Next up. As a result of our renewed ties to Gannett that we established at the last meeting and some discussions that took place after, the UA has been invited to be a full voting member of the Student Insurance Advisory Committee. We will be talking about or introducing a resolution tonight to fulfill that request. And we have been assured that we will be invited to be a member of the Health Fee Advisory Committee once it is established. Next. The policy 6.4 working group had its first meeting on April 15th, and they discussed the state of policy 6.4 as well as UA resolution 7 from 2012, which was part and parcel of the creation of moving campus code precepts into policy 6.4. The concern was that there was no EA or faculty senate representation at the meeting, and it was not clear that they had appointed a rep. So I bring that to the attention of the faculty members and employees here. Please talk to your assemblies and ask them to get some representation separately. Yes, and we'll get that to, or please send it directly to you later. And we will be soliciting public feedback on policy 6.4. I guess it's already up at shared.cornell.edu. Next, I'd like to welcome, we have now 16 of 18 seats filled on next year's University Assembly. And I believe some of the new appointees and electees are here tonight. Matthew Indimini, who's been here before. Gabriel Kaufman, welcome. Is Mitchell McBride, welcome. Alexander Thomas, you go by Alex Alexander.
Okay.
Alexander, welcome. Is Catherine Kierman here?
She's not here.
She has also been appointed. And welcome back, Ulysses. May 5th, Tuesday, there will be a short UA meeting to close our remaining items of this assembly's legislative agenda, followed immediately by an organizational meeting for next year's assembly. The new assembly will need to determine if they wish to hold full elections at that time or appoint an interim summer leadership team. It's really up to you whether you want to do it all now or do it in the fall. Either way, I am rotating off the assembly, and so I will be prepared to facilitate whatever elections you choose to hold. Next, President Skorton has formally responded to UA Resolution 4 recommending the appointment of a faculty advisor to the Office of the Judicial Code Counselor. He has accepted our resolution and a faculty advisor will be appointed. President Skorton has responded to UA Resolution 5, which was support from the Office of the University Ombudsman. In that resolution, we'd asked for support for providing for a new assistant ombudsman. He has agreed to take that under consideration, not a promise, but to take it under consideration. And he has teed them up to have a discussion with President Garrett within her first 6 months in office. That ends the UA Execs report. Are there other reports from other assemblies? Hearing none. The first item of business of the day is UA Resolution 12. Mr. Battaglia, you want to bring us up to date on that resolution?
Thank you, Mr. Blair. Just briefly, this resolution is largely intact from a intense form. It's just the operative clause and the result clause have been changed after consulting with the Cornell Bicycle and Pedestrian Committee to reflect what the committee is doing and to make the resolution strengthen the resolution's call to action by enabling the committee to zero in on issues they think they are even at some degree. And that is about the change. Furthermore, I would like to make a small amendment on line 20, where it says, line 21, where it says, who all passed away this semester of class-related fatalities, changes to passed away this academic year. I just brought to our attention that Rosalind had died in December, not making this semester.
Any other reports?
That is everything. This resolution will draw to a vote at our next meeting and make that through the detail of the changes that we made to it.
Okay, so let me make sure I got it right. Before I was asking for the attention of a working group, now I'm simply suggesting recommendations for and 15.
Well, it is casting out, the group recommending to the existing committee what we'd like to do is work on. We worked with Bridget Brady and the relevant parties to this.
Okay, but the only thing that I don't particularly like is if I'm on a committee and I'm actually doing research, I do a resolution and I sort of see it as an indication of where I go. I bet they will look at the speed limit as it just seems in light of not having any other information to have. Maybe we should just trust them. The other thing, too, I noticed in the back, I mean, are they actually conducting meetings at this point?
They will be. That's my understanding that they are still
in the process of getting organized.
Which is why we're putting things in there to remind them of the UA incident and also the request that they provide the report.
I was just thinking that maybe October 31st might be a little soon if they're probably not going to get started at the beginning of next month.
The committee actually exists. It needs to be energized.
Okay.
Bridget Brady thought that date was achievable.
Okay.
She also did not have objections to the discussion of the speed limit. She knows it was true.
Yeah.
She
did
also
know it's
fact
true.
That you will
do. Yeah. Just wanted to make sure that we weren't trying to let them do their research and then let them decide if they discuss, I guess, is what I think.
Any other discussion on R12? Then we have an amendment to line 21 to change the word semester to academic year. Are there any objections to that change? Hearing none, it is adopted, and we will schedule this for a vote at our May 5th meeting. Next item is UA Resolution 13, recognition of outstanding support to the AY 2015 legislative session. This is the omnibus of everybody who came to talk to us and spoke to us on all the different issues, including tonight. So we've recognized Mr. Smith in here as well, so it should be current. This is for introduction tonight. Again, we will bring this forward to a vote on May 5th. Please read it between now and then, and if you have additions, deletions, or some changes, bring them with you to the May 5th meeting. Any questions on R13? Next, turning to the first late edition, this is for vote. I know it was not keyed up, but this is a shared governance joint declaration in honor and celebration of President David J. Skorton. It was written by some folks and forwarded by Gina and Jim Batista to all the different assemblies. All the chairs and executive boards of those assemblies have reviewed it and accepted the wording. The intent is to give this joint declaration to President Horton at his bow ties and goodbyes event on May 1st. So that was before the May 5th meeting. It is not a resolution, it is a joint declaration, but not subject to the, and it is from this assembly. Are there any questions on the joint declaration? I know it was sent to you on short notice.
Motion to approve the joint declaration.
I move that we approve the joint declaration.
Second by Mr. Meese. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the joint declaration, raise your placards. I will count my vote as 14. Against? Abstentions? The joint declaration passes by a vote of 14-0. Thank you. Next item, UA Resolution 8 revised. This is for reintroduction. We had given members the text of this previously. The Campus Planning Committee made some revisions. They have now approved a fully revised charter this morning. Mr. Lassell, our CPC liaison, was there. We agree with all of these changes and recommend your support. But the wording has changed from what you've seen before, so we will bring this up for a vote at our next meeting, May 5th. The next item is UA Resolution 14, Bylaws Change, Establishing the Student Insurance Advisory Committee Liaison. This item also is a result coming from our discussions with Dr. Corson Reichert. We have been invited to formally have a voting member on that group. This would actually then add Student Insurance Advisory Committee Liaison to our bylaws, like we have the Policy Advisory Group Liaison, the Council for Sexual Violence Prevention Liaison, and the Campus Planning Committee Liaison. We could add this to that list. It is fully coordinated. It is accepted by the chair of the Student Insurance Advisory Committee. It's recommended by Dr. Corson Reichert. This will be coming up for a vote at our next meeting. Questions on any of the last three items? The last two items is the voting for joint declaration. Seeing none, and that we are concerned. I would like to welcome back Mr. Ulysses Smith for assembly, but now in a capacity dealing with well, we won't get that off, I think. Yeah. Dealing with four new destinations and some information he wants to get our input and involvement on. And I turn the floor over to you, Mr. Smith. No, but if you'd like to, we'd be glad to help you.
Okay, just let me excited about the credit. Okay, so hello. For those who don't know me, my name is Ulysses Smith. I'm the coordinator for inclusion and compliance programs here, also the diversity and inclusion strategy specialist. I'm the queen title, it's complicated. And I know it seems like, you know, a lot of you are here to hear this presentation for the second time, because it is that good. It's even right here. This is great. But I want you to know it gets better every time. So I've been tasked by the Associate Vice President, Lynette Williams, in the Department of Inclusion and Workforce Diversity to figure out a way to start engaging different groups, particularly the shared governance groups, in the D&D initiative. So that's basically what we're going to run through today. And I'll try to brief you as quickly as possible to get some questions, but we don't have time for questions. But we're just going to kind of briefly go through the process for creating D&D initiatives under the current framework, how those initiatives are implemented and evaluated across the university, and the tools that are available to each of the assemblies, including for actually creating those implementing those. The juicy stuff is going to be the review of the new federal executive orders and why exactly we're really calling on the assemblies right now to be involved in the process. And then finally, how you can go forward in creating your plans and hopefully getting this on your policy agenda for the next meeting. Well, that is really small. Don't worry about it. But you don't need to know all of that exactly. It's just kind of the highlight for those of you who don't know Cornell's structure. It's a little different than other places. We don't have a special diversity officer. It is our mentality that everyone is essentially responsible for this. So the top five people on there are the university diversity officers. They're responsible for their particular constituents, in the May. Graduate school will be, so that's the change actually, is instead of Sherry Taro, you now have Sarah Hernandez. In the faculty side, you have Yael. Yes.
Mary Opperman, Vice President of Human Resource Safety Services, and Lynette Chapel Williams. Is that clearly direct contact?
Yes. So it's the top five people of UBOs, and then the people underneath that are both their supervisors, plus Susan Murphy, the president, and the provost. Those are people that make up the direct contact here. So your initiative, as I was already told, I'm the primary reviewer for these things, but once they come through me, they will be able to the UGC at large, who has the potential. So quick review on tour to destinations. The first thing you need to know is this is not a plan. It is a framework. There is a big difference in semantics, so it is kind of important to say that. A plan does not necessarily give you a directive in that sense. We provide principles that each unit, college, and school needs to follow. So most of this is administered centrally, but it is handled for the most part on the local level. So every unit across the university is responsible for creating their own set of initiatives. They have to be based on the four core principles of composition, inclusion, engagement, and achievement. There are a couple changes that we're having this year. In the past, we focused a lot on composition, so every unit has to, out of their five initiatives, at least one of them has to be based on composition. That was to kind of address in the immediate era our issues with student recruitment, retention, all types of things like that. However, the point of T&D is to get people away from stopping and thinking about diversity as only the compositional piece. We want people to not only focus on getting different people in the room, but also what happens once different people are in the room. How are they actively engaged in the processes? Are they allowed to take part in the decision-making process? Things like that. Are they taking advantage of the opportunities that are available to them across the university? How well are they actually embedded into the very fabric of Cornell? That's what we're getting at now. So we've introduced two-year themes. So this year's theme will be the lived experience. And in the document you all put that was circulated to you earlier, there's a whole session dedicated to that. I would encourage you to read that. It also gives you a clear definition of the four core principles. And there's also a piece about measurement, which I'll talk about in a second. But the thing also to note is that we're decreasing the number of initiatives that are required, with the understanding that many units across here are very different sizes. The president's office is not as large as arts and sciences, and therefore that we feel that they should not have to be five initiatives because it's just a bit of a hassle. So the number is now down to three or four. All initiatives must be measurable. That was something that was very hard for people to kind of understand in the first couple cycles, but now with the templates and things we're releasing, which I'll get to in a second, I'll make that more clear about what the practice is. So the process for creating these is a little different across the university. So most colleges and schools at this point have, and units for that matter, actually have diversity councils that they've actually formed. Some colleges include students, some do not. So if your college does not include students, I suggest you to get on that. The same could be said for faculty and staff. If you feel like you are not represented on your university council, it's probably a good idea to figure out why that is the case. For the assembly, there will be you all either as an executive body or as a body at large. You don't have committees that are dedicated to addressing issues across your constituent groups. We're looking at the committees that actually kind of, I guess, devise a lot of these initiatives. So that will kind of be where yours comes from. So the ESA and your inclusion and diversity initiatives. I think Canada Welfare is probably maybe the better arena for the UA, but whatever structure you see fit is the way to go. Once they usually are responsible for dividing these initiatives, and they are usually embedded as part of people's strategic plans or policy agendas in your cases, they are approved by the deans of the colleges and schools or the vice presidents of the units, and then ultimately sent to the UGC. It should be noted that, we'll talk about this again in measurements, but that it should have been sent back. There was a document you circulated that was actually prepped for President Garrett coming in to show her what we were talking about, and good initiative, mediocre initiative, not so great initiative, and what was a really exceptional initiative. So that's also there. You want to really utilize the appropriate committee in order to make sure that people are involved. And we're really harping on getting people to look for opportunities to collaborate. So on the website, diversity.cornell.edu, it's an interactive piece, and you can actually see all the initiatives that every unit has done over the past few years. instead of reinventing the wheel, we would encourage you to partner with other units or colleagues that are doing some of these initiatives in order to kind of save resources and that way save money. And then also publicize your initiatives. So one of the downfalls, and the reason we're figuring out a lot of people don't know about CMB is because people do not advertise what their initiatives actually are. So you can't see this, but this is what we're looking at when we're talking about evaluation and measurement. So this is the reporting mechanism. So the first half of that, which is kind of darker colored, is what's already filled in. That those are the initiatives that the colleges have. They have to identify the constituencies that have impact, what they're actually using as a measure, as a piece of measurement. So if, for instance, in this example, it's based on admission and recruitment. Then we want to see for measurement, well, how many people actually registered for your events, how many admissions events did you hold, what was the change from last year or in previous years, what measures you had, how many people were actually admitted, how many enrolled, and then further on down the line, how many people actually finished graduation. If you're doing training, pre and post surveys to see if there is some sort of learning that occurs, different things like that. That's what we're looking for when we're talking about measurements. It's not enough in the final piece just to say, oh, we tried to do this thing, don't go well. No, we can't do that. You have to tell us what you did, what steps you took, why it was challenging, if there was a challenge. If you're going to go forward with the initiative, then are you revising it? Is it something that's going to be institutionalized in your unit from now on, or the funds that are going to be dedicated to it, or if it's under revision, why? What things are you revising exactly? And you have to explain that. And the last column is just our notes. But this is coupled with the actual narrative report that everyone must submit. It's also part of everybody's annual report, so it means part of the annual report also. So what does our office actually offer? Our office will provide you with templates, which you just saw, and you are all circulated a lot of those templates that we have, that those are the standard things we're using for reporting now. We'll provide examples of cultures and other methods to help you communicate your initiatives to people. There's a database of all the previous initiatives, as I've already mentioned. We also have a lot of demographic information, not just the diversity dashboards, but from other climate surveys that we've conducted, not just through IRP, but also through our department. And we also will help you devise survey tools if you're looking to do things in your individual unit or department. We also have diversity lead contacts and contact as a member just to kind of help you out and get you connected to people who are already doing some of the initiatives that you're thinking of. And of course, there's a consultation to help you refine your initiatives and training opportunities. The heavy fun stuff that we're going to get into is the changing federal landscape, the regulatory landscape has changed. If you do not know, as of April 8th, there was a major executive order that went through that prohibited discrimination based on gender identity and sexual orientation. Since we received copious amounts of federal funding, we are subject to this. It is a very big deal. Though Cornell is progressive in the sense that both of these categories are already included in our non-discrimination policies in our EEO statement, it's still causing us to change a lot of our practices, and we're actually broadening the scope to students too. So this is one of the reasons why we're calling on you all. There are also a lot of things that pertain to veterans that have come down, and particularly interesting are a lot of the new regulations that pertain to individuals. So we really need the Assembly's help in focusing on these three areas. And there was, pretty sure I circulated a piece of a spreadsheet that we put together. Our office is conducting a couple very large policy meetings. So we are essentially looking at every policy that is LGBT specific across this campus in every arena. So housing, admissions, facilities, athletics, whatever it is, that's what we're thinking. We've also processed that with best practices that we've gotten from studies, from best employer applications, from our ranking applications for students, just to see where we are and what things we need to improve on. So we've identified a few areas that did need some help. The same could be said for a lot of the disability initiatives. A lot of your purview pertains to the facilities and infrastructure, which is something that needs to be addressed immediately. Some code changes that might come that are going to come up for anti-bullying policies, particularly workplace bullying, and then directing specifically sexual assault, which was already mentioned about revising the system before. So the essay asked us, when I did this presentation the first time, we didn't get a slide like this, was, okay, well, what can we do now? In addition to that spreadsheet I gave you, a couple of things we really need done. Design standards. UA passed a resolution in 2011 about bathrooms and facilities. facilities. Well, things have changed since then, and that standard is just now being worked on for whatever reason it took so long. But this, the bathroom usage policy and actually design standards for family facilities and universal restrooms making it accessible and publicizing them across campus is something that needs to be done immediately. Not just for compliance, but also for the sake of being done. Being able to change preferred names and gender identities and gender markers in your employer, in your employee records, or as a student. Also, accessible media. Oh, YouTube in here at University Relations. It is amazing how the brand book actually does not meet these standards for creating accessible presentation, which is interesting to think about. So that could be a key engineering initiative for next year if you want to think about that. Also, adoption benefits, extending the conservancy, all kinds of things that we're looking at. So that's just kind of a broad overview of things, like your campus welfare committee, your infrastructure committee, all types of things. So if you, all initiatives are due July 1st, so if you could send those to me, hopefully by then, you got a sample of the SAS plan from about 2 years ago that's available, and you can also use the plan or the templates that are available for community. So with that, I will take a question.
We are essentially at time for this item. Are there any brief questions? A lot of the, Ms. Beth?
Is the assembly called or a unit?
So you are under unit. So the reason, again, the reason why we're extending this invitation is because a lot of people, we've learned a lot of people still don't know about CMP. And because some units or some places, like for instance, the NEST and Federal Student Access Services, FAS is a unit and it creates its own initiative. Well, maybe even the Office of Assembly Systems of Administration might want to do its own initiative, and y'all girls could be different because we're so policy based. Mm-hmm. And they might not actually fall into or the actual initiative of the other unit. So it's an opportunity for other people to engage in the actual process. And you won't be held to the standards as quickly because, again, you're not a unit, but it is a way to actually be more engaged and actually get a lot of students done.
Thank you very much. If members have other questions or concerns or want to engage Ulysses directly, he's going to be on the assembly again, effective June 1, and you'll see him May 5th, I'm sure, or you can send him directly or through me any questions you have. Thank you very much for your time and your presentation. Now we turn to the main item of the day, which is UA Resolution 6. Owing to a conflict on this resolution that I have, we have declared Chair Pro Tem Matthew Battaglia, who will see us through this issue. I turn the floor to you, Mr. Battaglia.
Thank you, Mr. Blair. Before moving into the reintroduction of Resolution 6, I have received a request from Mr. Edwards and D.C. DeCefano to modify it immediately in order of the day so that they will go second. So we'll be switching items 5 and 6 on the agenda. As I know that this has been discussed previously, I must bring it to you for discussion and a vote whether or not to entertain the request to switch the order. But
they are.
They're asking to go second as opposed to first.
Well, we made an agreement that it would be in this order.
Well, but that's exactly why we dropped this assembly, because in a deviation from the order today, I recognize the president to be successful and never rationale for going second.
I guess my only comment is I don't see if there's a request to go in a different order, why we wouldn't honor that if it's such a lock solid argument or presentation. We should be comfortable no matter where we fall to hear either side. So out of courtesy, I don't have any objections to that, and I guess I would be in favor of changing the presentation if they felt that they didn't have the presentation being made today in advance. By all means, let them see the presentation and then be able to respond to it.
My make the, a vote on this after I've made the introduction to the resolution and feel like it's warranted to make that shift, that's fine. But in the introduction, I make it clear that there's no need for that change.
Thank you. However, I would ask if you talked about beforehand, just once we're in the thick of it, it would be good for who likes to continue moving. The Assembly in the past traditionally has accommodated courteous requests for consideration. Seeing as there is contention in this issue, I am going to request a vote to restate all those in favor of my debating order today would vote affirmative, all those against would be keeping the existing order, allowing the director officer to go first would vote no. With that, all in favor of debating order today and allowing the director officer to go second, please raise your placard. All opposed. All would like to abstain.
There was a vote in the back, but
yes. By a vote of 7-5-1, we will deviate from the orders of the day and allow the investment office to go second. I then turn to you, Mr. Knapp, for 5 minutes to reintroduce resolution 6.
I first want to state that there have been three additional endorsers and sponsors of the resolution in the UA. Professor Ron Holter, Neurobiology and Behavior, Professor Alice Lowe, Professor of Veterinary Physiology, and Ms. Kai Wing Wong, who's graduate professional student association. They can be added with as a friendly addition to the sponsors of this resolution. I've given you all copies of my notes because there's some questions here, so I'll read it fairly fast and hope that. Last month at a debate at Cornell, on Cornell investment from Fossil Fuel Company, sponsored by Cornell Student Assembly, both the faculty speakers arguing against investment, earth science professors, admitted their acceptance of the significance of anthropogenic causes of climate change and the dangers that climate change presents. When we hear that both those for and those against investment are convinced of the threat that climate change poses to the Earth as we know it, then we realize that there is agreement among them to most of the whereases of our divestment resolution. That leads us to consider the three whereases and the first resolve in this resolution that concern the financial implications of divestment. The University Assembly invited the Cornell administration to present its position on the entire resolution, and the University administration chose to have two members of the Cornell Investment Office give their response. Apparently, the administration also regards the financial side as the central area of debate. And as this divestment resolution notes in lines 58 to 60, in Cornell's climate action plan for carbon neutrality by 2035, the Cornell administration and Cornell trustees who ratify the plan accept the scientific and moral imperative of acting to combat climate change. Bearing in mind that the financial side of this resolution is what is debatable here, in mid-March, more than a month ago now, we asked the Cornell Investment Office to give the UA an outline of their arguments against divestment and to give supporting documents for their arguments in enough time for all the University Assembly members to read them. The investment officers have sent us nothing. From beginning of this process, we, the divestment resolution sponsors, have included references to support documents for the points we have raised. One of our supporting documents discusses the financial side of divestment. It's called Financial Implications of Cornell Investment and Divestment Strategies for a Sustainable Future. This document has been available on the UA website to the UA for over 1 month. It was prepared as support for the Cornell Faculty Senate resolution on divestment that was overwhelmingly endorsed by the full Faculty Senate over a year ago. The compelling arguments in this document support supporting the financial benefits of divestment have only grown stronger in the past year. We can only conclude that if Cornell had divested a year ago when the assemblies and the Senate suggested that they do so, the university would be in a better place financially than it is now. In the past year since this document was written, Cornell's administration has said that it did not want to take what it calls the financial risk that the investment office claimed they would be taking by divestment. The authors of the divestment document I mentioned above had estimated that based on long-term fossil fuel reserves. The bottom line of his calculation was that the risk of divestment a year ago was minimal. And in fact, in the past 12 months, the energy sector has dropped 16%, while the overall stock market has gained 12%. Roughly speaking, that means that our publicly marketed energy investments, the ones that an original UA resolution a year ago, which never saw the light, wanted to divest from, probably lost Cornell's endowment about $45 million. The private partnership energy component, which is twice as large, 6% of the endowment, probably lost Cornell's endowment an additional twice that amount. Now, as I said earlier, we, the sponsors of this resolution, asked the university investment officers, who will speak today to provide sufficient financial data to address the particulars of our UA resolution. We ask them not to speak with general descriptions of divestment risk or the nature of the endowment structure. These general areas of discussion are not pertinent to the specific terms articulated in our resolution. We ask them not to advance arguments that are based on their misconception of the resolution or confusion of the resolution with prior resolutions from Cornell assemblies and the Faculty Senate. To be specific, resolution number 6 makes clear and well-defined terms for divestment that Cornell divest from companies holding the largest fossil fuel reserves on an approximately linear schedule aimed at complete divestment by no later than December 31st, 2035. It behooves those who oppose to divestment on fast financial grounds to speak clearly and concretely with numbers and simple calculations of their estimates of risk pertinent to the terms of our resolution. This is a simple and appropriate request. We look forward to reasons and clear reasons, not to appeal to the emotion of fear.
Thank you for that. Now we will turn to the presentation of those in favor of the resolution, modifying the order of the day. I believe that will be given by Mr. Birdfall, Mr. Howard, and Mr. Shalloway. Do you have some slides?
Point of order, could the member please speak up?
No. Somewhere between 2031 and 2053, we used to think we were all working together to slow this down, conserving energy, doing research, the oil companies developing renewables. We were awakened when economists found that the stock market prices of those big coal, oil, and gas companies depended in large part not on current production, but on their underground fossil fuel reserves, which were counted as financial assets. These reserves are 3 to 5 times the world carbon dioxide budget, and if all firms will have a prehistoric climate. So the companies holding these reserves are in a financial bind. If government responds to the scientific warnings, their underground assets will be devalued, their market valuation will crash, and investors that don't get out of time will lose. They could respond by moving capital to new renewable technologies, but they're going the other way. Expanding reserves to maintain short-term book value and selling off their renewable investments. They won't respond until societal pressure gets the government to incorporate human costs into the financial equation. So what are we to do? We've done our best with research and journal articles, our scientific organization published advisory data summary. There hasn't been a fossil fuel company opposition. What has gotten attention is the investment movement. The administration claims this investment will cost too much. We've been asking for almost 2 years for data that hasn't been given. This is a university and we expect informed debate, not of unsubstantiated pronouncements. This behavior is inappropriate and is reason enough on its own to pass the resolution. As Marty said, we've already provided you our data. I'll briefly summarize. The targets of investment, 100 publicly traded oil and gas companies, comprise less than 3% of our endowment. And the resolution calls for a phased investment over 20 years, following our on-the-ground move to carbon neutrality. Put the numbers together. the investment office is going to say today. But what they said last year was that the public energy stock outperformance, that is performance above just kind of an index benchmark in our portfolio, added $100 million over the last 10 years. How good would our stock picking would have had to have been for that to be true? Simple calculation. $100 million outperformance in 10 years means $10 million a year. The average of the endowment was about $4.8 billion during that period. 3% max would be affected. That means the investment we're talking about was on $145 million principal. That means a 7% outperformance, that is above market average, per year. And that's without compounding. You adjust the compounding, that comes down a little bit to 5.4%. Still, broad market was 8.4%. At 5.4%, that means our public investments, ExxonMobil, that sort of thing, is 13.8%. The energy market itself is 6.7%. That means that we picked stocks so well that we've got double the performance on energy. I'd like to see the data. If we really did pick that well, imagine what we could do picking stocks where we didn't have the energy headwind. In point of fact, because the amount of investment is so small, there's hardly any difference between an invested index and a non-invested index. Here's the cumulative return of $100 million invested in the S&P 500 for the last 10 years with and without fossil fuel companies. Investment does a hair better, but basically no difference. Here's a different one, the Morgan Stanley Capital International All Country World Index. Invested 10 years, no real difference. The administration has picked one particular study that I haven't used to focus on, but there are a lot of studies, and I can show you lots of graphs like this. The only one that argues otherwise is the flawed oil industry funded study. Now, it's true that divestment is going to cause a tiny increase in endowment just in variation because of a loss of diversification. But this is tiny. This is our income over the last 7 years. The fluctuation is about 15% standard deviation. The loss of diversification might add 0.05% to that. But the investment office's claim that it's impractical, we'll hear what they say today. In the past, they claimed it's impractical for our people because we'll lose the best advisors if we ask for any constraints. In spite of the fact that the amounts we're moving is small, you can buy and sell Exxon at Vanguard whenever you feel like it. And are they the best? Here's charts in the Cornell Sun showing how our investment returns compare with our Ivy League peers over the past few years. In 2011, it wasn't too bad. We were just below median, but we've been consistent ever since then, second from the bottom every single year. We could have done better just investing in a broad market index, and maybe changing advisors isn't such a bad idea. And these advisors don't come cheap. You could get the index for 0.08% cost. Standard, I don't know what we pay for them. Standard for managed funds, about 1.5%. That'd be $57 million per year on the 61% we have in equity. That's past performance. What about the future? No one can predict it with certainty, but we can anticipate some structural changes as the stock market reacts rapidly long before we see any actual reductions in fossil fuel exploration or carbon tax. The warnings are coming. Here's one I used a year ago from the House of Commons in England to the Bank of England. Now, more recently, the Bank of England is warning its investors to get out. Here's one from Henry Paulson, George Bush's Secretary of Treasury during the 2008 crash. Here's one from the world's biggest private bank. Big tech companies that have more capital than the oil industry are starting to move in. And the poorest countries have recognized the dropping prices and have made renewables their best option for development. Tide is turning, the investment future is changing.
Okay. So I want to begin with a review of last year. I don't want to give too much away, but the theme here is, and they said it couldn't be done.
Okay, so it was a few weeks after we heard here last year that any restriction on our investments would cost us hundreds of millions of dollars, that Stanford announced it was divesting from coal. Okay, so you might have seen it. A lot of people did. This is one page of me listing the first few days' coverage of that announcement. New York Times, LA Times, Reuters, Financial Times, etc. There is no sign that this decision has cost Stanford anything. Its endowment is larger than ours. It's growing faster than ours. Now, this could be for many reasons, but clearly they are managed well. So it was suggested, too, 1 year ago, that only small institutions or foundations would divest. Then last fall, the Rockefellers led foundations worth a total of $50 billion in divestment pledges. The standard divestment pledge timeline, by the way, is 5 years. Okay? And that's far less than the 20 we're proposing. At any rate, I'd note three things here. Number one, $50 billion. That is a big number. Two, Rockefeller. That is a big name. That is the first name in Boston. That's often the name of that building next door. And three, the Rockefellers turned to divestment only after engagement with companies like Exxon Sale. So let me repeat, shareholder resolutions and years of meetings did not work for the Rockefellers with the company that their family had built. Now, a year ago, it was observed that Norway's sovereign wealth fund, the largest in the world, had considered but not divested. Okay, well, now they have. The $850 billion fund, well over 100 times the size of our endowment, has divested from 114 companies, many of them coal and tar sands companies. These are not publicity stunts. These are business decisions reflecting the common sense that what's environmentally unsustainable is financially unsustainable. That short-term thinking is short-term. More and more, investors, like the over $1 billion Guardian Media Group, are divesting from fossil fuels not despite, but because of financial concerns. So one obvious point in all of this is that saying that others haven't divested is only true until they do. The World Council rules. Churches at 500 million Christians. But more importantly, saying that others haven't divested isn't leadership. A month ago, we could have said no school in New York has divested. We can't say that anymore. This is a fossil fuel divestment, not just a coal divestment. Okay, so now we might say, instead we might say, no Ivy League university has divested. But that's not a leadership statement. And I don't want to wait for Harvard to tell us it's okay to divest. So this is Harvard last week. This is a sit-in from last week, and it's ongoing. And the takeaway here is this. This is a movement with serious momentum. This is a movement learning how to win. And the smart question anymore is not whether, but what it will win. The first thing is binding global commitments to reduce carbon emissions. Okay, we'll see those this fall in Paris. And those will carry market implications for an industry already on the defensive. So I'm not going to linger here because we all know about this, but I can remember back over there in 2013 when our investment office told Kyoto Now that fossil fuel investments, quote, stabilized our portfolio. Now I wonder if they still say that, because these are some of the most volatile assets out there, particularly if you assume they're recovered. Okay. Since 2013, fossil fuels have lagged and will lag more and more behind alternatives and new power. And you can forget climate change just for a second and talk about jobs. All of this is good because clean energy means more jobs and better ones. The solar industry now employs more Americans than coal. And as Professor Schaller put it, much of the cost of solar is installation. And that guy climbing around on your roof to put solar in, he's going to live and drive it. And if renewables can and do compete already, it's all the more amazing given the enormity of fossil fuel subsidies. The G20 countries spend around $100 billion yearly subsidizing exploration for more fossil fuels that, as we've seen, we can't burn. This is crazy. The World Bank says, end it. Total yearly global fossil fuel subsidies are estimated at well over $700 billion. This doesn't include, by the way, the military costs of guarding pipelines, oil fields, shipping lanes, etc. But you'll hear sometimes, let the market, let open competition decide between fossil fuels and renewables. But look at those subsidies. Open competition is exactly what we have never tried. That's exactly what we're asking for, and fossil fuel industry should see it. By the way, if you took 1 year's worth, and I think if you took 1/10 of 1 year's worth of those subsidies and you gave it to renewables, you would do more for renewables than the fossil fuel industry has in its entire history. And it's sheer fantasy that fossil fuels are the main drivers of renewables research. Between 2002 and 2012, Exxon spent $188 million on alternatives. In the last two of those years, it spent $250 million on advertising, all the while taking in roughly $45 billion per year in profit. And its advertisement mostly is talked about its seriousness about alternatives. So let's get back to the basics. Among climate change researchers, there is a widespread view that a 4-degree Celsius warming is incompatible with any reasonable characterization of an organized, equitable, and civilized global community. 4 degrees is also beyond what most people think we can adapt to. If we burn what many people think we can adapt to, if we burn our fossil fuel reserves, we will see that rise and far worse. If we don't, valuations are going to change. Now, a bubble is precisely that which, like in 2008, traditional financial analysis doesn't see. But you can see them if you think. Thank you. In a word, that's my word, that we aren't thinking. Because the investment premise that I hear from the investment office, that fossil fuels are going to remain indispensable as an investment vehicle and as a fuel for decades, is very literally unthinkable. One of the comments on this resolution notes that on the Centennial Memorial, there's a timeline of Cornell's history, an event maybe every decade. From the 1980s, it's the anti-apartheid movement. That's what we commemorate. That's what we choose to remember. This is from exactly 30 years ago. That's the Friday before. That's the Monday after. I'm going to need 30 seconds. We're going. Boom? Okay. April 21st. Okay, so at first, of course, back then, the investment office and trustees said no. They said it'll cost us. And they said it's only symbolic. Everything we hear these days, we heard then. As for only symbolic, from an Oxford study, and almost every divestment campaign was reviewed from adult services to Darfur, from tobacco to South Africa. Divestment campaigns were successful in lobbying for restrictive legislation. In the case of South Africa, that legislation was the 1986 Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act, widely perceived as the death knell of apartheid. And in the wake of that legislation, Cornell divested over $100 million, over $200 million in today's terms, from companies operating in apartheid South Africa. Okay? That is far, far, far more than we're talking about divesting in this resolution. That's the precedent. Any argument from precedent is an argument for divestment at this university, because the precedent honors it. This is who we have been. Who are we now, and who do we want to be? Thank you.
Stock outperformance has added about approximately $100 million over the last 10 years.
recreated our performance. These are not simulations. We recreated our portfolio until we did not have energy within the public stock, within the public parts of the portfolio. And this is the same reference that we made last year, but I think it's relevant because a lot of the other studies are also similar to what the Ontario group did in terms of looking at the impact on divesting and basically saying that there would be no impact on divesting. Based on our actual performance, there would have been an impact to the performance of the endowment over time. And while $10 billion a year may not seem like a lot, if you put $10 million a year in the context of the balance of the university's budget today, which for the most part, as President Stewart said during the town hall meeting just last month, is $1 million here on the NPA campus and $3 million at Weill Cornell Medical Center. So in total, the university is balanced to the tune of $4 million. $10 million is significant and something to think about when you consider the financial position of the university. So when you think about the practicality of divesting, we invest in managers across a variety of asset classes. We do not hold securities directly. And I would also point out, and we talked about this in the past, but I would also point out that our friends at Stanford, our friends at Harvard, our friends at Yale, our friends at Syracuse, they do not own. Harvard does in certain circumstances, let's exclude them for a moment, but Stanford and Syracuse, these two that I mentioned specifically, they do not hold securities directly. So I want to make sure that we're clear when we're thinking about and talking about actions that schools have taken. We hire managers, we partner with managers across all different asset classes. Over half of our portfolio is illiquid, which means that we've committed to private partnerships, and typically these private partnerships have lives that extend upwards of 10, 12, even 15 years. They are illiquid, which means once we commit, once the dollars are invested, that's it. They're there until the conclusion of the investment, which is at the discretion of the manager. The other thing to think about is we are $6.2 billion in a world dominated by larger endowments, also dominated by extremely large pension funds, both U.S. and international, and I'll mention two U.S. pension funds in particular in a couple of slides, but also foreign sovereign wealth funds to the tune of hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. Those dollars are coming here to the U.S. Those dollars are competing for capacity with the same managers that Cornell is competing with. You can go back 30, 40 years ago and you never, or primarily did not have a case where the client was competing to gain access to a manager. That's flipped now. There's so much capital to be invested by a variety of institutions that we now compete. And there are times when even Cornell, as prestigious an institution as it is, there are times when we cannot get capacity with the managers we want to partner with. Something to think about. So when you think about our process, when you look at manager selection, you start with the asset allocation. So how do we want to allocate our $6.2 billion? So the bylaws say that the investment committee has the authority to establish the asset allocation for the endowment, which the investment office, we recommend, we work with the investment committee, the investment committee establishes the asset allocation, deciding how do we want to allocate the $6 billion. My job and the job of my office is to find the managers to allocate those dollars to across all of the different asset classes. Our goal, and it takes time, our goal is to continue to partner with what we consider to be the best-in-class managers and be able to stay with them over long periods of time. Now, we've looked at this a couple different ways. I discussed earlier about the value that the energy position within our portfolio have added over the last 10 years, which is $100 million that we referred to. If we look at it a different way, so what if we were to say that we weren't able to be the best-in-class manager, and we were forced to invest with the median manager across different asset classes, and they're talking about the equity too. So if we were to only invest in median managers, the difference between median and our managers, so the outperformance that our managers have added over the last 10 years, is about $165 million, give or take a little bit. To put that in perspective, that's 7%
roughly $2.3 billion taken out of endowment in spending over that time period. And that amount is about 70% of that. If we look at, okay, what if we were to invest with index securities, several references to index securities, our active management added roughly $260 million over and above index. That equates to about 11% of that same payout. Now, I would want to take a moment and put these numbers in some perspective. I put the $10 million a year in perspective relating to the budget and the balance where we're at, which is roughly $4 million across both the Ithaca and the Wild Cornell campus. If we were to think about, let's just round it off and talk about 10% of the payout. So the payout in the last fiscal year was roughly $300 million. So 10% of that is $30 million. What does $30 million mean? Well, $30 million is 12 to 13% of undergraduate financial aid. $30 million is roughly 4.5% of faculty salaries across both Ithaca and Wild. And finally, $30 million is roughly 4.5 to 5% of staff salaries. So I'm sharing these percentages with you because I just want you to understand the magnitude of these numbers. $10 million in the context of $6 billion, that's a big difference, but it's real money. It's real money, and it makes a big difference when a budget is balanced to the point where we're at, and you think about the activities that are going on right now in terms of thinking about the budget that we have to cut here to get up there. It's important to remember. This is also in the context, and President Scorton discussed this at the town hall meeting, this is also in the context where if you look across the entire university and look at research grants are roughly flat year over year, and over the last several years, research grants have been flat. This is also an environment where the state, with aid from the state of New York, so with the relationships we have with our contract colleges, the aid from the state of New York is down significantly. I think the number is like 31%. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that is down 31% over the last 7 years. And then finally, financial aid, if we just look at undergraduate financial aid is up significantly over the last 5 to 6 years. For the most part, it's doubled. When you think about all that in the context of the continued pressure on the administration and the board to keep tuition increases at a lower level, we've been successful in slowing that down, but when you think about all that, you want to think about the implications of performance within the endowment, because that's the one area where we are continuing to increase the payout. Financial aid going up, state aid coming down, research expenditures are flat. Keep that in mind. So, if we think about the impact on the energy industry from divesting, so there's a reference to the 100 fossil fuel companies. There's also, as you all know, I'm sure, there's 100 coal companies out there. So there's this list of 200 companies that's put together by the carbon tracker, this group over in the UK. As of this morning, I had one of my analysts run this for us. As of this morning, those 200 companies have a market value of $4.3 trillion. $4.3 trillion. If you look at the Ivy League, just the Ivy League, the two of the Ivy League, roughly speaking, there's about $100 billion of assets there. Thank you. Today, we have, Cornell has about 1.8% in exposure to public stocks, roughly speaking, 1.8%. So if we were to assume the same exposure across the Ivy League, and it's not, I know other schools that are much higher, but let's just assume that they're all the same. That equates to $1.75 billion, 0.0004%. Cornell is 0.00003%, 100,000 of a percent of the value of those 200 companies. The act of divesting itself would have no impact on those companies and their share prices. So, if we look at the renewable energy sector, we talked about this last year, and it's still relevant today. Returns to renewable energy projects that are highly reliant on government subsidies you also want to think about, you know, the efficiency, the productivity involved in those workers that they're doing. There's a big difference when you're relying on subsidies, when you're relying on tax credits. That does not make a good recipe for investment returns. Now, we have about $90 million, give or take a bit, in renewable and sustainable investments within the endowment. That's up from a year ago when we met. It was around $70 million. Today it's about $90 million. And on average, our returns there have been zero over 5, 6, 7, 8 years. Zero. Now, that's much better than going to zero, which is what a lot of investors have done within the renewable space. A lot of smart investors in Silicon Valley, a lot of the partners that we're partners with, at one point, 5, 6, 7 years ago, had renewable funds, dedicated renewable private equity or venture capital funds that are no longer in that business because their returns were so poor that they had to get rid of it. So this is the other concept that we want to think about. We talked about this last year, the independence of the LPI, not using the LPI. We want to make sure that we operate independent of political special interest projects. Obviously, there's the Sudan policy that President Thornton signed back in 2006. We make the point here that we did not fully divest from South Africa. There was some divestment. But in speaking with trustees that were around back then and understanding what we actually did, while we did divest, we remained invested and we adopted something called the Sullivan Principles. Learned Sullivan Principles, I would encourage you to look those up. We have not funded projects that others, there have been other projects that we've been asked to fund. Student housing, College Town, a facility at JFK. And we want to make sure that we're not setting precedents because if we start doing this, there's such things as slippery slope. I want to make 2 points and then let CFO discuss it. Who, by the way, I just want to make for the record, she is not part of the investment office. I am the chief investment officer. I run the investment office. Joanne DeStefano is the chief financial officer. Her job is the overall financial responsibility for the university, just for the record. So we talked about this last year. Two things that I would add to this. CalPERS, which is the pension plan in California, just the other day came out. They have $300 billion. They said no to divestment. CalSTRS, which is the teacher's retirement system in California, they have $190 billion. They are studying the idea of divestment. The CIO is out on record saying that he is against divestment. That is a lot of money. The other thing that I would also want to clear up, too, is the Rockefeller brothers. They have about $900 million. And their statement related to divestment is very mushy. If you actually read what they said, not as clear cut as what the headlines might have to say. We've walked through all this before. I would just summarize. You know, we do respect the concerns on the global carbon footprint. Joanne DeStefano is going to comment on that. There is a real cost in cost of divestment. Both in terms of what's happened, but also now the oil price and gas price funds are actually creating opportunities. We do not believe in doing things that are symbolic. Joanne DeStefano will comment on things that are real and tactical. And I'll just leave it to that. The alternative action by pointing out she's going to comment on herself.
I actually want to say that I agree with almost everything that you said when you started with your resolution. I think that we're all concerned about the environmental concerns and that we really need to look at what we agree with and the fact that we do need to take action to reduce the greenhouse impact. That Cornell needs to be a leader. I read the comments that so many people wrote regarding the resolution. And you agree that Cornell can and should be a leader in sustainability and improving the environment. However, I do not agree that divestment is the solution. AJ has talked about what the implications would be, but even if the university divested, and in the entire Ivy League divested, the fossil fuel companies are providing a supply demand, a market demand, that hasn't been replaced yet. And until we can replace with alternative energies, there's going to be a demand for fossil fuels. If we can take our dollars and put them into being a leader in making better energy cheaper than fossil fuels, that's where the university should put their limited dollars. I have...
You are on our time. Can you just wrap up briefly?
I was just going to say, we just need to focus
during the discussion, if you'd like to remain, I'm sure if members have questions, we will be directed to you, responses, we will be able to.
Thank you.
We will now move to discussion about the resolution as a whole. Before we do so, for the University Assembly bylaws, we do allow public comments for 24-hour notice. The chair has received one request for comment for Mr. Joe Rowland. We will now recognize him for 2 minutes if he'd like to comment on the proposal, the resolution.
Okay, I didn't realize I was going to go at this point, but that's fine. I have to say, it seemed a little bit strange to me to have the investment officer pull this switch, since he held the cards, and the cards that the proponents of the resolution had were all out. So we'll just make that comment briefly. But I'm an alumni, lifelong local farmer, and I'm in favor of this resolution. I think that the fossil fuel companies have really extended themselves a great deal in public relations, political campaign contributions, legal challenges, the executive actions at the federal and state level. And they've made it very difficult to move forward on collaborative, bipartisan approaches to dealing with climate change. And I think that those of you that think we need to do something would agree that we're between a rock and a hard place. And I think that a quotation from another farmer who actually owned the farm that we're sitting on right now, and he's a relative of mine, Ezra Cornell, said to his son, who held on to who became governor eventually, "Remember that knowledge is power. It is the Archimedean lever by which the world is moved." And I propose to you today that divestment, symbolic though it may be, is a lever by which we may move the energy paradigm. And I urge you, if you're thinking that maybe you will support this, that you will support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rowland. Now we move to discussion among members. Anyone would like to comment? Dean Burke.
I have a point of order, actually, point of information. I see in line 47 where it says financial analysis by the Cornell faculty senate has shown such and such, and I am unaware of such action by the faculty senate. I know that the faculty senate usually does not do that sort of analysis. Our financial policy committee did study this case, albeit 18 months ago, and they were quite skeptical of the arguments that were being made today.
I turn to the top of the resolution, would you like to clarify?
Should that say Cornell faculty senators?
Maybe some Cornell faculty senators.
I believe the faculty senate voted overwhelmingly to support the resolution.
The resolution says nothing about that finding.
About what?
About this finding.
Which finding?
Has shown fossil fuel investments over the past 10 years. The resolution doesn't just look there.
I would allow others to comment on their information.
Say,
there was an appendix to the resolution, and the financial statement was in the appendix. Indeed, it was not by Senate, it was by Senator. But and the appendix was officially submitted to the Senate. I'm not exactly sure what happened to it, but it had all the financial details.
If maybe then should a friendly amendment might be that should make some faculty senators, or the whole thing should just be dropped. I should just read financial analysis by many impartial public and private research funds, rather than being inaccurate. I think it should be accurate.
I agree. Gene, is that a motion to amend it to the line over? Do you mind reading what you'd like the line to read?
Financial analysis by many impartial public and private research funds.
So we're striking by the Cornell Faculty Senate, correct?
And.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have that? Okay. Other comments?
$2.1 million without having to do anything. Just sit there. I wouldn't even need a financial manager. They're offering CDs right now, 2.1%. I just heard it on the radio. So are you saying that it's not possible for the financial managers we have to take an additional $10 million a year and invest it to get as deep what you would get if it was invested in the energy sector? Are our financial managers that dumb? Is the rest of our portfolio so poorly invested that another $10 million invested somewhere else would just be lost and you completely forget that it even exists? When you were doing your model, where did you put that $10 million per year? And so you put your model about what, where we would be. I'm just curious about how what you did with this $10 million a year.
Are you referring to the impact from having energy over the last 10 years and the 10 million?
No, it's your, I don't remember which one it was, but that's the one that actually looked what would happen in the future if we get that.
So I didn't actually have a chart or statement about the future if you're talking about.
Okay, well then, okay, then I'll just ask you about the future. So do you
sure.
think that, you know, faculty salaries would disappear, students would be, you know, living in Europe out on the art squad, if $10 million a year from our investment portfolio was reinvested somewhere else, that we couldn't do at least as good as we're doing by investing in energy?
So if we're thinking about the future, so one of the things that we also have to think about is, so in the context of us being long-term investors, we're always thinking about where are the opportunities, right? And putting aside the comments about the impact of the oil price declines and the gas price declines over the last 6 months, because those numbers are, the chart on oil prices and gas prices is a little bit accurate. The impact on the portfolio is not accurate. But looking at the opportunities going forward, which is what we're already doing, there are significant opportunities that are being created in the current environment as a result of the drop in prices. So that's something that we are in active discussion with the investment community. Thinking about what are the opportunities that are being created, how can we take advantage of those opportunities. All of our friends, all of our peers, are also having the same discussions with their investment communities, thinking about the opportunities that are being created by the disruption in the current disruption in gas and oil prices. So I don't think it's, you know, the question about faculty salaries or being put in desserts, but rather what we think about is the opportunities that are being created at the prices that we see today, and what does that mean for expected returns going forward.
So you're actually saying that the investment committee is looking at investing, not forget about divesting, but taking advantage of opportunities and taking more money from the endowment and investing to the energy sector.
What I'm saying is that is the job of me, of my office, and the investment committee to always look at opportunities, whether it's in the energy sector, whether there's subsidiary or derivative opportunities being created across other sectors as a result. And it may have to do with the energy sector or may not. But there are always opportunities being created when you see disruptions. It's not a question of necessarily being $10 million a year or $9 million a year or whatever it is, but the ability for us as long-term investors to be able to take advantage of opportunities to generate the returns that we need to support the university within the risk parameters that have been established by the investment.
Andrews, I don't want to make this personal, but I want to use David Chalouet as an example of somebody that comes. What's your policy in dealing with, say, a faculty member that comes in good faith about some issues such as this? What kind of information would you give me for her?
So, in general, the policy that we have has been established by the investment committee. So this is a personal visit, nothing to do with me. The policy that's been established by the investment committee that involves the chief financial officer. And to a certain
I was asking what the fund is.
I want to disagree with the elimination of by the Cornell Faculty Senators, revise the words to say by Cornell Faculty Senators and accepted as a part of the resolution on divestment, overwhelmingly supported by the Faculty Senate last year. Because that codicil was overwhelmingly supported in the Faculty Senate resolution, it was an appendix to that resolution.
And it was an appendix, which I believe very few people were aware of.
Well,
and
that's their fault.
And all that was passed, I believe, Marty, was the resolution
passed with an appendix. The appendix said those following things, and faculty senators who voted overwhelmingly for it accepted that. And I think that's the correct representation of what occurred. I don't think we should stand away from the fact that the faculty senate actually voted overwhelmingly to support the investment last year. I'm motioning to change that to say, whereas financial analysis by Cornell faculty senators and accepted as a part of the resolution on divestment overwhelmingly supported by the faculty senate last year and by many impartial public and private research bodies.
So, do you have that? Okay, before we move further, the resolution is now a motion to amend or move a discussion on Mr. Hatch's proposed alteration. Anyone would like to comment on that alteration?
Yes, sir. Point of order, there should be the second,
okay.
And then there needs to be some process because actually Joe's resolution was not actually
voted on
or decided on, so it's currently still exists as is.
Correct.
Thank you.
On that point, Greg, I believe that it my resolution or amendment was taken as a permanent amendment, and so it need not be voted.
Well, wait,
it
has to be the proponent. I didn't accept it as a proponent. I think it was a oversight that it was not voted upon, and so we are now working on a particular amendment.
Yeah, I don't think in Robert's rules, my information, that there is actually such a thing as a friendly amendment, but I could be completely wrong.
There is not a friendly amendment. That is correct. I have intended to put it through. Based off previous resolutions in the NLVA, I was going to put that at the end of the question was called, but as there is discussion, we will now move into discussion about whether or not this should be strict, whether or not Mr. Hatch's text should be added, and then from we move from there. I mean,
so if are we commenting now on the change, the amendment?
Right.
Second.
Okay.
Just,
actually, I think
Joe's
amendment needs to be addressed before the line is
Well, it wasn't seconded.
It wasn't presented for a second, so it needs to be addressed properly.
Dean Rose is right before a motion to strike when you, I believe you said it was, but the record.
I would like that struck.
Is there a second to Mr. Dean Burns' request?
I'll second it.
Okay. Moving into discussion on the original striking.
So I think there's clearly some confusion amongst members of the faculty, senate members of the faculty, the dean of faculty. I don't feel confident being able to approve something. And there's been so much talk about data. In fact, I don't have this information in front of me. We're going off the various opinions of multiple folks. So I struggle to do my duty without having that information to make that, to have it in here, because there clearly seems to be some dissent about that's not actually the facts as they were put out there. But I guess I'm looking for more right now, and I don't think in the time we have it would be more. So I would be in favor of striking it from it, as opposed to strengthening it with further language on faculty senate's overwhelming support.
This is actually quite an information. If we do strike it and then we propose another amendment to the same portion that would clarify that it was from an appendix, et cetera, wouldn't we have to vote on that by a two-thirds majority so it would take twice as long to do the same thing?
You are correct because we'll be rescinding the previous action of previous action. So therefore, if we were to strike it and attempt to re-add it, we require two-thirds vote because we would be modifying our previous action. First, shall
we? We think a public comment on this?
We need to use the Senate website,
but I have on my computer.
shouldn't believe everything you read, but I have sitting on the Faculty Senate website, Faculty Senate Resolution, Motivation, Carbon Neutrality, Is Feasible, References, we're now up to page 6, top 200 listed companies, page 8, then I have statements, I don't see, and I have listed the signatories. I think these are published. I'm not sure what's on your website.
Yeah, I don't know if you're one of
It's just a well-studied fact, and we can talk about it for 5 studies. It's a math that anyone can do. We can talk about MSCI. We can talk about standard indexes. It's a well-studied fact that fossil fuels have underperformed their emissions over the past decades. And I don't understand why the investment office pretends that this isn't true and continues to cite flaws in the study that we have never referenced. That's my first question. My second question is, why does the investment office pretend that renewables are the main beneficiaries of not the fossil fuel industry? Number 3, why is this manager's issue, which is so important here at Cornell, why is it not an issue at these other schools? Why is it not an issue for these other funds? Okay? They like their money there, too. Number 4, I would like to see more data and less scare tactics. Okay, they've come here and they've said, we have big numbers, which are very bad news to you, but they have not provided the data, no matter how doggedly we have asked for what is now 2 years. And the 5th thing that concerns me actually the most is there is no acknowledgement there of the problem of unburnable carbon. Okay, and that's the kind of thing that can really catch us the way 2008 caught us in a bad way. That can hurt us. My
comment. Question actually directed towards
Yeah, Peabody Coal, largest coal company in the world. In their latest SEC filing, they note divestment could have a major impact on demand for our product. I've got a slide if we want to do that, but I mean, okay.
The target of divestment is the American people. If you're speaking, we're putting our money where our mouth is, and the goal of that is to get the political momentum we need to get the things that really will affect things, cutting down the fossil fuel subsidies, carbon tax. This is basically a political action move. From a straight dollars and cents point of view, I mean, I can argue with that exact number, but yeah, that's not. They're not direct targets, they're indirect targets.
Yeah, can I add, I just want to add one thing in response. Okay, so they took our money and they divided it by the broader fossil fuel investment pool. Okay, and they got a small number. Okay, and that's maybe that reflects how small we are. And then we compare that to potential costs. Let's do a similar calculation. Okay, and that so they conclude. Okay, this is just a symbolic act. Let's do a similar calculation. Let's take our emissions. Okay, and let's divide by global carbon emissions. And you're going to get an even smaller number than that number. And our efforts to reduce emissions have a proven cost of hundreds of millions of dollars. The Carbon Action Plan has a proven upfront cost. And it's to make a smaller impact. If we don't care about the small impact, it's going to make a smaller impact than that number that you talked about there, which has no proven cost. I mean, they do. So that's another thing.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. First, with respect to that, in your introduction, you have in quotations this fluctuation. What does that refer to exactly? A 0.04% fluctuation?
Mr. Shalvey can answer that better than I.
Whenever you cut down your range of potential investment, you lose diversification.
Yeah, you refer to that too, but if you reinvest it, how do you know that you lose the diversity?
Oh, that 0.04% isn't a loss, it's an increase in fluctuation.
Okay.
And frankly, over 20 years, it's going to average out. And like I also said, we have a 15% fluctuation, so it's totally normal. But that is the one point at which you can say, yes, you're going to lose a little bit. So it's 0.04% fluctuation added to 15% fluctuation, which actually is going to be
the
story.
But can I ask one more question?
Yeah,
the $10 million is the estimate of what we need to divest annually? Or I didn't see if the resolution binds anyone to that figure. So
although Mr. Edwards said he talked to me a lot, that is true, but he hasn't told me anything. The only number we have received from them is that it's a maximum of 3%. They have not even told us what percent actually do we have invested in these 100 companies. All I know is it's less than 3%. Every other fact they gave you is publicly available. So if you take that 3% number and you multiply it by 6.2 billion and you divide it by 20, then you get 9.3 billion a year.
So, sorry, the resolution doesn't bind anybody to $10 million.
It does say a linear reinvestment. So, in point of fact, that is what we are saying.
Okay, several quick points. I think whether this was unintentional, like it was an accident, or it was on purpose and Mr. Edwards did not realize that he was contradicting himself, I can't be sure, but he did say that we don't hold our securities directly. He then said that Stanford and Syracuse don't hold their don't have their holdings directly, and then said we can't divest, but they can. Using that logic, which makes sense to me. But anyway, moving on. What I wanted to bring these assembly members' attention to are these comments. I don't know if all of you have taken the time to look at them, but at the end of the day, we do have this process for a reason, and there were many people who commented on this resolution. We're not at this meeting today, and I think that if we do not take into account what they said, it does not mean that we have to vote necessarily the way the majority of them want us to. But in the represent these people, so we should be taking what they have to say into account when we are making our final decisions and voting on this, and we should keep the whole Cornell community at large.
Point of information. Since this was Robert, do you have any idea the percentage of faculty, staff, grad students, undergrad that made these comments, or?
It is listed in the comment system, so I was able to calculate them. I read all the comments as far as they were in favor or opposed. I had no way to verify what the standing of the student who or the individual input them was, so I have no information.
Because I would just want to make sure it's completely reflective of our entire community, and not just the specific set of either students or faculty, if we're going
right.
to say it's reflective of the community.
Just
well,
the
everyone has the opportunity to submit a comment.
This is a point of information. The University Assembly received a letter 2 months ago, which was entered into our minutes, with close to 200 email addresses of people in support of that.
There was a letter.
There was a letter which was recorded in the
minutes. Yes, it was recorded in the minutes since it was received under the UA exec update.
As someone mentioned, this is primary photograph, and I mean, the reality is, it's like a lot of things that we need to do because we have to, because we need to. And it's true that there can be a price to pay for doing things that you need to do. And to be honest, when you actually look at the range of negative effects that could occur when you divest as been recommended in the resolution, I mean, it's actually a relatively small price to pay. It does come with some risks. And I do acknowledge that in some ways, there will be a disproportionate effect on different portions of the community. I mean, I'd imagine, for instance, that because of their position, staff would be more at risk than faculty or community. Students would be here for 3 years, that's about it. Faculty would probably have some issues concerning the pay, that's true. Staff are probably more concerned about losing jobs. But the reality is, I think it's small, and I think there's actually a potential for us as a community to work together to come up with ways to minimize any potential negative effects if we occur. I mean, so I'm willing to acknowledge that there is some risk involved, but I don't think that's going to change the world.
Mr. Blair.
For me, the issue of finances is interesting, but it's really not important. We have very little of our, I mean, whatever the numbers are, in our long-term investment pool, in fossil fuels. Timing the market, nobody knows what it's going to do. They might be right about the carbon bubble. They might not. We might lose some money 1 year. We might gain it back another. But the issue for the sponsors and others isn't whether we divest because we're trying to save money for Cornell. It's about saving the planet and the greenhouse gases and the sustainability. So it's symbolic. It's symbolic to the industry. It's symbolic for Cornell. Symbolism is very powerful. The negative effects for me, some of which have been recently touched on, are the politicizing the endowment. So there are other world events that will come and say we should divest in, for instance, last year, as I recall, you know, some Middle Eastern issue divest in some Middle Eastern issues because of other things going on in the Middle East, et cetera. You need to consider that. And you need to consider that Cornell does have students in petroleum degrees and all of that. I guess what I'm telling you is I think the financial downside or upside is small either way. So for me, the financial piece is not compelling. It's really, does the symbolism in your mind create gravitas and perhaps what the sponsors might hope and these policy changes that might lead to cascading effects versus affecting people at Cornell in these fields, hoping to have jobs in these fields, relations and donor relations in these fields, and slippery slope of politicizing the endowment. I'm not offering one side or the other, but those to me are the real issues at Cornell. Thank you.
We have expired our extended time. We have one person left on our speaker, Mr. Manny Musumizi, and then someone on the second speaker, Mr. Gerkwald. At this point, I either need a motion to extend or a motion to call the question.
Call the question.
Call the question.
Call the motion to a second.
Second.
Okay, in that case, the motion is to call the question. All those in favor of UA Resolution 6, please raise your flag.
Is there any
Is there
any yeah, I do have dissent on this, because I don't think we should rush this. So I do dissent.
Dissent to what?
Calling the question.
Okay, there's whether we vote on it.
Well, correct.
There's been a motion, there has been dissent, therefore we'll need a two-thirds vote. To, you will vote to vote, two-thirds vote will close the debate, move the vote, anything left will move back into...
Mr. Blair. Do we need a two-thirds vote to close the debate if time has expired?
Per Robert's rules, no, because it should be, we either need a motion to extend or a motion to call the question. So if we, barring the motion to extend, we either need to call the question, that would be fine.
The question, my point of order is, do we require two-thirds to close the call the question?
No, you do not.
Okay, simple majority.
Yeah.
Thank you for hearing.
We have time. Just that, like you are correct, it's a motion to table that motion will withdraw. So, therefore, if time has expired, all those in favor of calling the question, please raise your black card. All those against calling the question. By a vote of 11-5-0, the motion to call the question carries. We will now move to voting on the main motion. All those in favor, do it resolution 6, please raise your flag. All those against, please raise your flag. All those who like to abstain, please raise your flag. Therefore, by a vote of 11-4-1, motion to resolution 6 carries. As we have prior time, I therefore move to adjourn the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.